When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. And this is, well, you know.
They're sending people that have lots of problems. And they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
After Donald Trump finished sewing up the paranoid racist vote recently, this happened.
Trump has been surging in the Republican polls, up to second place in the first primary state of New Hampshire.
That new national CNN poll also has Donald Trump polling in second place behind Jeb Bush.
But look at Donald Trump here at 12%. He is bleeding off a tremendous amount of support from the field.
That's pretty impressive, huh?
Yeah, it's not fair to call Donald Trump a joke candidate anymore.
No, it's fair. From birther ravings to comparing Obamacare to Nazism to declarations of native Mexican criminality, Trump is absolutely a joke, along the lines of the kid in geometry class making fart sounds in his armpit. What's not a joke is how the press reported those poll numbers, and most others. Republican races, Democratic races, general elections. It's not funny because journalistic malpractice, especially serial malpractice, is no laughing matter.
The CNN poll shows Jeb Bush in the lead, followed by Donald Trump, right. Followed by Huckabee, Ben Carson, Paul.
It's hard to even know where to begin, but let's start at the most basic. In the poll cited, Bush isn't ahead. Trump isn't second. Mike Huckabee isn't third. Due mainly to small sample size, the margin of error in the poll is 5 percentage points, which means their actual rankings could be entirely different. Though reporters tend to add the margin of error as a kind of boilerplate disclaimer.
The polls have a 3% margin of error.
So there's a 5% margin of error in this poll. So
margin of error of 4%.
It isn't some sort of obscure technicality. If the margin of error is 5%, that means you can add or subtract 5 points from any result and be just as accurate. Which means that in a tight horse race, the numbers are so rough as to be literally meaningless. Meaningless.
According to a new CNN survey, 46% of debate watchers said the president won the debate. 39% said Mitt Romney did better. There is a 7-point margin of error, though, so it's technically a draw.
Secondly, the contest for the 2016 Republican nomination isn't a close horse race because, for now, it isn't a horse race at all. Just a lot of nags milling around the paddock. 32 candidates for one nomination to be decided a year from now. Never mind Skip Andrews, K. Ross Newland, Kerry Bowers, Dale Christensen, and John Dumet Jr. Most voters have never heard of Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, and Lindsey Graham. They have heard of Donald Trump, who has a lot of name recognition, like Justin Bieber, Al Sharpton, and gonorrhea. Recall that at this point in 1959, when Adlai Stevenson and Senate ingenue John F. Kennedy looked toward a crucial Ohio Democratic primary, Ohio polls had Kennedy trailing Missouri Senator Stuart Symington. This year, with about 75% of Republicans undecided, polls at this stage are little more than a familiarity meter. In a head-to-head race against Skip Andrews, gonorrhea would probably lead by 30 points. That's what the anchors mean when they say,
I think it's really too early to be looking at any polls in the cycle, but
this is really early days, and anything can happen. I mean,
he sees himself as a serious candidate, and the polls see him as a serious candidate. But still, it's really early in this campaign. There's definitely
too early to tell. Well, here's a thought. Then don't tell it. Don't tell us anything you know to be of no informational value. And that especially includes any supposed poll results that, by definition, are misinformation.
95% of you said no, 5% said yes in this unscientific poll.
All right, let's put up the poll of people who watched. Very unscientific last night. But people who were watching, obviously that's a stilted group. Yes, no on pre- and post-speech feelings about whether the president's policies will move us in the right direction.
Now we're going to close the poll on our vote from our viewers. It's unscientific. They choose to vote. We don't choose them. 56% believe that an increase in the minimum wage helps the economy, while the other 44% believe it hurts the economy. Thank you for your votes on that, by the way.
Being unscientific doesn't mean the 56% number is possibly unreliable. It means the 56% number is worthless. Absent a projectable random sample, it has no statistical foundation whatsoever. Margin of error, 100%. In other words, it's a fake. And no perfunctory shrug of acknowledgement excuses journalists for passing along counterfeit data, any more than a pharmacist can be excused for dispensing counterfeit medications just because he might call the formulation unscientific beforehand. People swallow the stuff anyway. The trading in phony polls, often justified as interesting and fun, is a toxic disregard for the truth. It should be simply unthinkable. Like, I don't know, passing along alarming unconfirmed reports on breaking news.
There have been reports of gunshots heard at the Navy Yard. This is just a report right now that is unconfirmed.
Or permitting to go unchallenged demonstrably false assertions from self-interested advocates and charlatans.
Without a doubt in my mind, I believe vaccinations triggered Evan's autism.
Or letting nakedly political spin pose as news analysis.
What did you think was President Bush's strongest moment?
I have to confess I didn't have any of those moments. I thought that the president just didn't have a plan for the future and that John Kerry was once again just absolutely masterful.
All right, thanks very much, Senator Hillary Clinton.
Thank you.
Oh, right. They do that, too. The Dominican Republic and Haiti share the Caribbean island of Hispaniola. The DR has about two-thirds of the land and Haiti the rest. Dominicans speak Spanish. Haitians speak the French dialect Creole. And while African-rooted Haitians tend to be very dark-skinned, Dominicans are less so. Though for a century Haitians have migrated across the border to cut sugar cane and do other work in the Dominican Republic, they've always been a conspicuous other, which has led, at the moment, to this.
The deadline for hundreds of thousands of Dominican Haitians to legalize their situation here in the Dominican Republic expired.
The government says the law aims to tackle illegal migration, but human rights groups say it stems from longstanding racism.
The 250,000 who don't have papers, Haitians will have to go back to their country, even though they've called the Dominican Republic home for years.
A recent constitutional court decision stripped citizenship from the children of undocumented foreigners, meaning mostly Haitian migrants, going back all the way to 1929. This, the latest chapter in a xenophobia that goes back at least eight decades. While the immigrant population integrated well into Dominican society, dictator Rafael Trujillo notoriously tried to whiten that society by every means possible, including massacres of Haitians. That history resounds as the Dominican government is once again in the separation business.
It is clearly an illegal act. It is an immoral act. It is a racist act by the Dominican government. And it's happening because these people are black.
That was Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City, home to many Dominican immigrants. Pope Francis has expressed concern. Human rights groups have called the policy ethnic cleansing, and some have even compared the prospect of mass deportations to Nazi Germany. Journalist Maria Isabel Soldevila is editor-in-chief at Listen Diario, a leading Dominican newspaper. Despite international censure, she says, the Dominican government is using the High Court ruling and other laws to proceed with its registration plans and what deportations may follow for those who can't or won't comply. And the media, including her own news organization, have defaulted to a kind of resentful nationalism.
Most media in the Dominican Republic have taken the defensive side, the sovereignty card. We need to put order in the house. Stay out of our business. And I think a lot of reporting has died in the process. And we've assumed opinions close to the government and the more conservative side of the government instead of just reporting on this problem that was created for thousands of people.
Now, you're a top editor at Listin Diario.
Mm-hmm.
Your title's editor-in-chief, but I guess you're actually more like third in command, right?
Yeah.
How much influence do you have in your own news organization to do the kind of unflinching coverage that you say is so lacking in the Dominican media at large?
I think we're no different from the other newspapers. In general, newspapers have been covering this topic from a very nationalist, conservative perspective. And the most we have been able to do, which is what we should be doing all the time, is send people to the places where things are happening to report as journalists. You have to know that there are no Dominican correspondents in Haiti, and there are no Haitian correspondents in the Dominican Republic. This is something unbelievable. So we're mostly taking reports from agencies, you know, from the AP, from EFE, or we have correspondents on the border. Listin Diario has been covering this issue, but I think there's a lot more opinion coverage than there is news coverage.
Maria, I certainly don't want to be guilty of exaggeration or over-dramatization.
Mm-hmm.
Comparisons have been made by human rights activists to Nazi Germany. Is this hysterical?
Yeah, I think it's too much. People are going back to 1937 and the Trujillo era, but I think too much has happened in the world for this to happen again. I don't think the environment in the Dominican Republic is one for this to happen. There is no asking people to say perejil like in the Trujillo era.
That's the word parsley, and it was used in the same way that the Khmer Rouge looked at people's hands for calluses, and if they didn't have them, they were killed as intellectuals. The pronunciation of the word for parsley depends on being able to roll an R.
Yeah, when you speak French or Creole, you don't roll them the same way. So, this is back from an era where Dominicans shed their blood as well, and we're regarded with disdain, and everybody condemns this issue in the Dominican Republic. We don't have the equivalent of Holocaust denial when it comes to the massacre that shames us.
So this is not parsley too?
I think it's very unfair. There are some really tough things happening. It's true that our families that are separated now because their children have papers and they don't have papers, but it has not been reported or documented by anyone that people are being thrown out of here by the police or by the military or by immigration. There will be deportations like there had been in the past in this country and other countries. The only thing I can do here is hope that the government would keep their word and that there would not be mass deportations, because that would be terrible.
Do you think that all of the international attention, especially by the foreign press, has influenced the government into moderating its behavior?
I think some of the coverage has been biased. I've seen reporters try to find the reality they came to look for, and when they don't find it, sort of try to produce it. But overall, it has helped a lot. I think the government is very cautious right now of making a mistake because the eyes of the world are here. I hope this pressure continues so they don't make the mistake, because they're not getting the pressure from the local media.
There have been voices in support of Haitians, and they have paid some consequences. Tell me.
A lot of us have been called traitors. We have been bullied in social media. Earlier this year, journalist Juan Bolivar Diaz and a couple of journalists that are very vocal about this subject received threats on their lives, or they were yelled at on the street. And they put up a traitor's book where a lot of journalists or human rights defenders appeared.
Are you in the traitor's book?
No, I wasn't in the traitor's book, but I was a favorite subject of one radio show. I mean, there's a lot of people in the media that are not journalists that are passing very right-wing agendas that do not tolerate people thinking differently. So
I would tell you that that's a national shame, but here, it's actually a big industry.
Well, maybe we imported it. I don't know.
You've been very candid about your own paper's shortcomings in covering this story.
Yeah, I hope I still have a job after this.
Well, that's my question.
No, I don't think it's a problem.
Will you?
I'm kidding. I've been very vocal about it on our editorial meetings. I've written about it in my own column. And on the TV show that I produce, I have been very open about my opinion, And it usually is different from the editorial opening of my own paper, which demonstrates their capacity of openness to different views of the subject, even if they don't agree with it, you know. So, no, I don't think I'm at risk. We are in a democracy after all.
In many places in the world, Dominicans are immigrants too, not only here in the United States, but also in Puerto Rico and Spain. Has that central fact been part of the debate in the Dominican Republic?
I don't think we've discussed that enough. And I think it's amazing how people can flip sides when it comes to talking about Dominicans abroad and when it comes to Haitians here. I mean, among the top three, you know, columns of our economy, it's tourism, free trade zones, and money transfers. And I think a country that depends so much on immigration, its people should be more aware of what it means to be an immigrant. Dominicans have been polled about whether they want Haitians to remain here or not. They have said, you know, anyone that was born here should get their papers here. I mean, people are not essentially against it. I think we've been involved in this political debate that was led by the most conservative, most right-wing segments of the political life in the Dominican Republic, and people have started to assume this speech of us and them. I think it's sad that we forget that sometimes them can be us, and that's a terrible thing.
Maria, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Maria Isabel Soldevila is editor at Least in Diario. She's also a Knight Wallace Fellow and hosts a morning TV program in the Dominican Republic. In May, she was one of a dozen Dominican journalists to meet with their Haitian counterparts to discuss cooperation. Coming up, Google's solution for people who would rather look at pictures of a cat than an ad. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we occasionally remind you, the golden age of online content you so enjoy is plagued by two ruinous facts of life. Number one, obscenely lucrative analog advertising dollars have been replaced by paltry digital advertising dimes. Number two, the consuming public doesn't want to pony up itself because we've all been conditioned to believe that all this great stuff is free. To stay in business, publishers therefore need to collect lots and lots of those digital dimes. Which brings us to problem number three. Users see advertising as not just annoying, but also as a creepy invasion of privacy, and increasingly they're obliterating it with ubiquitous software like Adblock Plus. So now, it's pay-up time. Publishers may possibly benefit from two ideas that take distinctly different paths to keeping the income coming in. The first, from Google, empowers ad-hating users by letting them essentially buy their freedom. And how? By using the very same real-time auction structures that allow marketers to bid on user eyeballs and serve ads automatically 24/7. David Stanky is a product manager at Google and works on Contributor. David, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How does it work?
So, you're looking at a web page, and you see an ad on that page, and you say, why is that ad there? The way ads appear on a web page is the publisher has marked an area, says that I want to make this available for advertisers. And in many cases, that's made into a real-time auction. Multiple advertisers are bidding, and the winning bidder's ad is placed into that spot. And this happens really fast in real time to decide which ad is going to display to the user. You might say, okay, well, what if I paid? Could I have that space? Contributor allows the user to participate in that auction in real time. And when the user wins, the user claims that space.
So let's say I use Contributor and I win a bid for a certain newspaper story at a certain moment. What are my options for what appears where the Geico ad otherwise might have?
So out of the box, we have designed a neutral, kind of non-distracting experience. It's a kind of a semi-transparent pattern that says simply, Thank you for being a contributor. But we do offer the user's choice of other options. And of course, this being the internet, the most popular option is pictures of cats.
Because, as we all know, the internet is run by cats.
The internet is for cats.
So, strictly speaking, this is not an ad blocker. It's an ad replacer.
That's right.
And the cost on any given user's page for any given space at any given time is what, a few pennies?
It really varies wildly depending on a lot of factors, including the user's browsing behavior, the page itself. It can be anywhere from a few fractions of pennies to several pennies. The user sets a budget of their choice, and as they browse through the internet, we bid on their behalf as they go around from page to page. That way it works automatically. The user doesn't have to think about it every single time.
Which is a very ingenious alternative to what has long been considered the savior of the a la carte internet micropayments, which enable you, without buying ad space, to pay for content as you consume it. The problem with micropayments being that the cost of the transactions has always exceeded the triflingly small amount that you'd pay in any given piece of content. This gets around that problem of high transaction fees because you're kind of paying in advance in bulk for a month's worth of purchases.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a micropayment system that's built on top of the advertising ecosystem. The advertising market sets the price, the market rate for ad slots, and the user then pays that as they go.
What Contributor has the virtue of is the certainty that you are actually paying not an arbitrary price set by a third party, but the market price for the actual value of the content as determined by the entire advertising marketplace.
That's right. And that was one of the great innovations of it. This started as an experimental project by an engineer at Google. And the aha moment was that this solves the problem of what he calls price discovery, that a publisher doesn't have to make a hard decision about how much it should cost, and nor should a user need to make a hard decision about whether it's the right price. This is market at work.
Although it assumes that the so-called right price is that deemed by the advertiser to be the value of your attention as opposed to the value to you of the content you're consuming.
That's correct. And the users can choose this option to go with the market price, or again, they have lots of other choices.
Yeah, like that Geico ad. Google gets 90-some percent of its revenue from advertisers in the search business. And therefore, I wonder how advertisers feel about its biggest vendor allowing users to do an end around to avoid their very ads. Has Geico called to say, what in the world are you guys doing?
Not yet. This, of course, is an early experiment, and we at Google are interested in preserving the health of the advertising ecosystem. We feel that it's better for everyone, all participants, to have informed and empowered parties, including publishers, advertisers, and users.
As alluded to in the introduction, the public has shown that it wants its cake and wants to eat it too. It wants to get the content for free and not look at the ads. Can Contributor penetrate that fundamental disinclination to pony up money for stuff that we're used to getting for nothing?
Well, there is an education piece here. And as we talk about the product, we do talk to users about how great content costs money to produce, and that traditionally comes through the advertising channel. As we do that, what we find is that users really embrace that concept. And the more that we talk about the publisher and how they're content creators and creative people, the more willingness the users have to open up and pay directly.
Now, the two aspects of Contributor that I think most commend it are that it improves the online experience. You're not inundated with ads. And the other one is that you're kind of explicitly supporting the kind of content that you use and believe in, kind of like putting tips in the guitar case for a street busker whose music you'd like, right?
That's right. It's tipping as you go without having to go through the extra bit of choosing every time. It just works wherever you go.
Yeah, and the other way to look at it is as sort of a mafia protection racket. Oh, so you don't want something unfortunate to befall your nice screen, like a credit repair ad. So maybe you just want to pony up for protection. We'll protect you, says Google.
We see it as empowerment via choice. We think ads are great and keep the internet free for those who choose them, and we're offering another choice for a user who would choose to pay with their own direct money to the publisher.
Okay, so you're not going to cop to being Junior Soprano. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Stanky is a product manager at Google. He works on the contributor team. There's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's more than one way to circumvent ad blockers. A startup called SourcePoint operates on the premise that if users only were schooled in the economics of the internet, they wouldn't be so stingy and ad-averse. Visitors to any publisher using SourcePoint technology can opt for the normal flow of ads, or choose advertising categories they'd more cheerfully entertain, or pay a subscription for content. And if education and choice don't change their habits, SourcePoint simply overrides their ad blockers. Company founder and CEO Ben Barokas acknowledges it's a tough proposition, but the alternative, he says, is the eventual inevitable financial collapse of the internet.
Indeed, the piper needs to be paid. As you said, the television and terrestrial broadcast advertising revenues have historically paid for the online business. And as everything moves to digital, this will have to change, and business modalities are slow to shift. And we're hoping to accelerate that change.
I know, much to your chagrin, your business has been described in the trade press as essentially an ad blocker blocker, but that's certainly part of the platform. How can you defeat my ad blocker?
Sure. Most ad blockers are built on an open source set of code, which maintains a whitelist and a blacklist of all of the servers that tend to serve advertising. It uses a number of algorithms that sits in your browser and looks to see if some ads are being served from these places. If, in fact, the user chooses to have their content consumption subsidized by advertising, we then go and, at the publisher's behest, circumvent that ad blocker and push the ads through. So it's not so much that we're blocking the ad blocker. We are just serving the ads that were meant to be served to the user, even in the presence of the ad blocker.
Yeah, by blocking the ad blocker. But we quibble over semantics here. My concern is, and we've seen this in other kinds of technologies, including going back to like caller ID. The phone company would sell you caller ID, and then they would sell others a way to block caller ID. Will the next startup funded with a $10 million A round block your technology for blocking ad blocker and so on?
Oh, I hope not.
Digital infinity?
The reason that we are in this situation with ad blockers is that everything up till now has been implicit in terms of, Mr. User, you will consume the advertising alongside of the content, and that is how it will be paid for. When users are opting in for specific kinds of advertising, then it works better for all three legs of the stool, for the publisher, who's getting compensated appropriately for the content that they're creating, for the user, whose content experience is exactly how they want it to be, and for the advertiser that doesn't waste their money on places and people that aren't interested in their message.
If you can get a critical mass of publishers to participate in this, and reducing consumers' options to get stuff for free and to sort of circumvent the whole publishing ecosystem, you can make this a kind of default platform that virtually every publisher uses. But if you don't, and there remains vast numbers of options for me to get my stuff ad-free without patronizing the publishers who subscribe to your service, then you make no headway at all. In other words, is this an all or nothing at all enterprise?
That has yet to be determined. A lot of the community is sort of yelling and screaming for some other way to fund media. And in my mind, that other way doesn't exist. There's either standardized advertising, there is personalized advertising, or there is subscription. And there is perhaps some mixture of those things that will be the optimal balance for each individual user or for individual publishers. But I think that we're working towards a sustainable media ecosystem. And when we find that solution, we'll make for a happier world.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Ben Barocas is the founder and CEO of SourcePoint Technologies. Sometimes Google is part of the solution. Sometimes it's part of the problem. The company's motto famously is "Don't be evil," but that doesn't cover being an accessory. In the wake of the Snowden revelations, we now understand the ease with which the government can access our search histories and other personal information, not to mention what data is sold or surrendered to marketers and data brokers. Which is why, as recently reported in The Guardian, more internet users are turning to more secure search options. Headquartered not in Silicon Valley, but Paoli, Pennsylvania, DuckDuckGo now processes about 3 billion queries a year, about 1/300th of what Google handles, but nonetheless a six-fold increase since Edward Snowden disclosed the role of Google and others in the NSA's PRISM program. So what's the duck's appeal? In particular, it doesn't collect any of your personal information or track your movements as you search the web, so there's nothing for it to surrender to marketers or the government. Gabriel Weinberg is the founder and CEO of DuckDuckGo. Gabriel, welcome to On the Media.
My pleasure.
What's DuckDuckGo's secret sauce apart from what ingredients it doesn't have?
So we're focused on this concept of instant answers. And the basic idea is when you're searching, you actually don't want to dig through web pages. You want an answer to your question. And there are thousands and thousands of awesome sites that answer questions very well for specific topics. So we all know Yelp for restaurants, but there are ones in every niche category, like for Lego parts or municipal bonds. You type in almost anything and we'll route you to the best source, format an answer for you, and put it above the links. If you want to try one, just kind of randomly type in some ingredients.
I'm going to type in vinegar, salt. What else is in ketchup? Tomato.
I'm crossing my fingers that something's good is coming up.
How to make an improvised explosive device. No, that's not what comes up. What comes up is sugar, salt, and vinegar red tomatoes recipes from food.com.
We have partnered with recipe search engine Yumly, who has good recipes, and we've gone to them in real time, figured out the best recipes, and formatted them above there for you.
Just to be clear, your business model is fundamentally like most search engines. You are selling ads against keywords, search terms that people type in, right?
Yeah, so it's really a myth that you need to track people to make money in web search. Google in particular runs four of the biggest ad networks in the world. AdWords, that's the search one. And then they also run AdSense, AdMob, and DoubleClick. Those are on millions and millions of sites across the internet. And they use the search terms to target you on all the other sites, including their own properties, but also these other millions of sites. And that's why you see these ads follow you around the internet. But none of that tracking is really necessary on the search engine, because there, the lucrative ads are the ones that you literally type in. So, you know, you type in mortgage, you get a mortgage ad. You search for car, and you get a car ad. And you can do that all without tracking anyone.
What about the search experience for the advertisers, the people who are bidding on the keywords? Are they getting the kind of response rates, the click-throughs, comparable to what Google generates with its search engine?
Yes, we are seeing similar engagement rates to other search engines. And in fact, one of the main differences between us and Google in the search experience is, and Google's been criticized for this independent of privacy, is they have a lot of their own services now that they're pushing, you know, like Google Places and over Yelp, et cetera. And so a lot of those things compete with advertising on the page, whereas our experience is much less cluttered.
At some point, it occurred to you that you were building a constituency, not of people who favored DuckDuckGo for its platform or the format of its search results, but by what it didn't use, and that's the tracking that you've just described. Did you immediately see that as a growth opportunity?
It was a personal decision, kind of on two fronts. One, I just thought it was really creepy that search engines could find out all this information about you, because once I started the search engine, I could see searches coming in, and they were the most personal things you can imagine, because people don't think before typing into the search results. You know, they just type in their financial and medical problems. Unlike a social network where you sometimes think about what you're posting. So that was one thing. The second thing was handing data over to marketers. Also, handing data over to governments was increasing. And I just didn't want to be part of either of those things. So I made this personal decision back in 2009. It didn't really attract much attention. Then 2013 came along, and all of a sudden, we're getting a lot of attention for not tracking people. And that's been great. However, people will not stay long-term on DuckDuckGo if the search experience is not good. I think people really don't want to be tracked. They want alternatives, but they also don't want any sacrifice.
One of the arguments for Google and many other web operations is that the data they collect are completely anonymized, that no advertiser knows that it is looking at Gabriel Weinberg's personal data. You're just a cookie on your browser. And they have no interest in you personally, just in your consumer behavior. It's a pretty compelling argument, actually. What are the flaws in it?
Partially anonymized, or anything, quote, anonymized, is never really anonymous. Pretty much every single time a data set has come out that people have claimed to be anonymous or partially anonymous, it's always been able to be de-anonymized. And that's especially true in search. And it's relatively easy to see, because if you have a data set of your search history, that means you have all the terms you've searched tied together. And you can figure out who that person is pretty quickly, because people type in their name and their address and things right around them and other unique things that will uniquely identify you. In 2006, AOL actually put out a, quote, anonymized search history data set. And very, very quickly, all sorts of people were de-anonymized. People had searched for all sorts of kind of crazy things. There was one case where someone searched for how to kill my wife. And it turns out that person, after they literally de-anonymized them and found their address, went to their house and figured out who they were. And they were a TV writer for a crime show.
That's a relief. Although, you know, it does show exactly why the government is interested in these sorts of things. They can harvest some pretty good information, including criminal intent, I guess.
With regards to the government, really the way I frame it is warrantless surveillance versus warrant surveillance. And we want there to be probable cause to get a warrant to go after this kind of data. And that's really the crux of a lot of the debate out there.
You have advocated for transparency regulation by the government. Tell me how that might work.
What I really believe is privacy policies should be more of a quid pro quo. So right now, the default is we're going to collect everything we can and do whatever the hell we want with it. And ours is the opposite. We don't collect anything or share it with anyone. I think there's a middle ground for most companies that need to collect some data, which is to say, hey, give us this piece of information and we'll give you this. And it's very explicit about what you're getting for what you're giving up.
Are you like the organic quinoa of the search business? Are you the artisanal search provider?
So what's interesting about the turn from 2013 to 2015 on privacy is there's all these surveys from Pew Research that increasingly show people are really starting to care, really noticing the ads falling around the internet, and really want alternatives. And these percentages are large. So the last one they did was 40% of Americans said they would prefer a no-tracking search experience. And so that says to me that this is really a mainstream effort, and there can be mainstream private alternatives in a bunch of categories even besides search. And that's just a function of people starting to really care and wake up about the downsides of digital tracking.
Gabriel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Gabriel Weinberg is the founder and CEO of DuckDuckGo. Coming up, reality television music is doing more than scoring the action. It's manipulating your emotions. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Summer is upon us. For some of you, that means days at the beach, ball games in the park, fireworks, barbecues, a cold beer. But for me, dear listeners, it means one thing. Hours upon hours of reality television. For instance, my current favorite, ABC's The Bachelorette. Here, Caitlin bears her soul to Sean B., confessing that she had sex with Nick V. after their last date.
I'm trying to figure out why you're telling me this right now.
I just thought it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I think you have to talk to me through this.
Yeah, no, maybe I should take a minute to regroup, go to the bathroom, and come back.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Not really. First of all, I don't actually watch The Bachelorette. Secondly, I've encountered more compelling drama on the back of cereal boxes. But if you listen to the music, you would think that Caitlin's romp with Nick V before the fantasy suite was a betrayal on par with the selling of state secrets to the commies. And this kind of instructive scoring is not limited to The Bachelorette. Last year, former OTM producer Laura Mayer set out to uncover the widespread emotional manipulation of reality television music.
TV is where a lot of us first hear music.
So my first exposure to classical music was via Bugs Bunny cartoons on Saturday mornings. For better or for worse, it informed my whole life.
That's John Burlingame. He's a film and music television historian at the University of Southern California.
Music can help you understand where you are in terms of time and place. It can help propel the action along by speeding things up or slowing it down. But mostly, music and television is designed to elicit an emotional response from the viewer and listener.
We've all heard about television's current golden age. Breaking Bad, House of Cards, Mad Men. Prestige television that has helped elevate TV to the rank of high culture. Film music has long been analyzed by academics and cultural thinkers. Movie fans can probably name a few film composers off the top of their heads. Jerry Goldsmith, Hans Zimmer, Danny Elfman. But only a true TV obsessive can name even one prolific TV composer. David Carbonara composed the Mad Men theme, by the way.
When I wrote my first book, which was called TV's Biggest Hits, which was a history of music and television in 1996, I was the first to really discuss the history and the importance of a television theme and the importance of dramatic underscore.
While there are academic journals devoted to obscure things like packaging technology and experiments in fluids, there are no academic journals devoted to TV music. Even though, if you're an average American, you're marinating in it. And many of us marinate in reality TV, and therefore reality TV music. Nielsen's top five broadcast programs each week regularly include more reality TV than sitcoms, drama, or news shows. Turn on your TV, open up your laptop, fire up that tablet, and you'll see reality television everywhere. You'll also hear it. You know, I must reveal myself here. I am a reality television aficionado.
My condolences.
Aside from the game-based shows, like Survivor or The Amazing Race, reality TV theme songs don't really matter. The focus is on the underscore that follows the characters and plays under almost every scene. The underscore serves an important narrative purpose. It creates storylines, sympathies, and the sense of reality itself in reality television. John Burlingame once wrote that television music is the soundtrack to our lives. The music from The Bachelor is the soundtrack to my life.
Will you marry me?
Yes, yes.
I tend to watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette with my wife on Monday nights. And it's a really painfully obvious manipulation of the audience when the music you're hearing is designed to suggest or move you in certain directions. If there's tension between, you know, The Bachelorette and Contestant A, you'll feel it
predominantly because you're being manipulated emotionally by the music that's playing underneath.
I can't control my eyebrow. I cannot control my eyebrow. I can't control what's on my face 24/7. If I could walk around with a smile on 24/7, I would, but my face would get freaking tired.
Generally, the music used in reality television is licensed very inexpensively from music banks. Hence some of reality TV's familiar generic music for terror, humor, romance, or extra romance. The Bravo Network, with its slate of prestige reality television, is an exception to the rule of cheap, generic music cues. Aaron Kaplan has composed much of the underscores for Bravo, including Project Runway and The Real Housewives of New York, as well as A&E's Duck Dynasty. You know, prestige.
Each season presents different characters, there's new storylines, so therein lies the challenge. The process in a lot of cases involves sitting down in front of your computer and composing using a sequencer.
If you're leaning in right now, you're probably a fan of Top Chef. This is Kaplan's song, Channel Zero, which plays during the crucial judging portion of each episode. Channel Zero is the signal that tells viewers to stop folding laundry, look up from email, put down Candy Crush, and pay attention now.
People who are fans of those shows do perk up whenever, you know, they get their cue. I mean, it's Pavlovian in a way.
Richard Lawson wrote Gawker's TV recaps for years. He's now VanityFair.com's culture columnist and no longer covers reality TV for a living. But when I asked him to review some of his old Real Housewives of New York recaps, he couldn't help but get sucked back in, as when he recapped the scene when two former BFFs had an epic falling out.
There's a scene as the kind of downfall of Jill Zarin began on the Real Housewives of New York, where Bethany Frankel has left her voicemail. And the first thing Bethany says is, get a hobby.
When she said, find a hobby, it clicked in my head. Mm-hmm. Over. And right. I really, you know, made a deposit in that friendship bank. I feel like she cleaned out our bank account. Yeah.
The music is indicating support towards Jill. But if you actually pared that music away, the voicemail that Bethany left is perfectly reasonable. But because of the way it was edited and the way it was scored, it became this sort of triumphant turning point for Jill.
The fact that so many people, millions and millions of people watch this drivel makes it important to really understand what brings us back.
John Burlingame.
And in some ways, it may be the music that is helping to make these shows successful by grounding it in some kind of emotional manipulation.
Drivel? Emotional manipulation? Those are some serious allegations. How do I feel about that? For On the Media, I'm Laura Mayer.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Maya Brownstein, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Joe Plourd. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.